this is a war between the government and the Tamil people.
I'm not a fucking terrorist. You are the terrorist.
People are crying out for justice in this country.
If you've got to be militant to achieve your aims and your aspirations, so be it.
There's a real hypocrisy from the big corporations.
The people from below will push for real change.
This Australia is going to be shocked, and then the public will say, what the hell's going on?
You're listening to RTR FM 92.1. This is the Indie Media Show, your grassroots activist news program, every Monday morning from 11. My name's Joni, and I'm joined by Ray. G'day, Ray.
Hey, Joni, how are you?
Yeah, I am well. A bit sore from footy training yesterday.
Oh, yeah? Doing the Reclink training?
I am doing the Reclink. First time for me.
Awesome.
Also joined by Alex. G'day, Alex.
Indeed. I thought, don't forget me, Joni. Thank you very much. But let's just talk about football for now, because Ray and I played football yesterday well. So a little bit sore in the legs, but no, it's great fun.
I'm wondering
where Raymond's team won, unfortunately, but we'll pass over that for a moment.
Where's the dog?
No dog this week. We got a new co-host coming in, Darrow, the new dog, but he's still a bit young, so you know, got to train him up.
We don't want to piss on everything.
Too nervous to talk in the studio. he felt he hadn't done his research sufficiently to come into the studio today. Better be in soon.
But a big show today.
A few
really important issues.
Yeah, so I will be chatting to Lua from Decrim WA and Smut Club about the federal government's recent decision to remove sex work from the NDIS, which has been condemned by, you know, a number of disability organisations around the country and sex worker rights orgs as well. You've got some pretty juicy stuff, Raymond.
I'm going to be catching up with Emma, who is a 17-year-old... a person who took part in a Disrupt Hub action on Friday. Emma and another activist blocked the road to the Woodside's Burrup Hub facility, the Burrup Road. They stopped work for some, at least I think half the day, locking onto a boat and a utility vehicle, a ute, there. So I'm going to be chatting to Emma about the action, about what's happening with Woodside's project, and also there's the Browse Basin gas field as well. And yeah, so it'll be good to catch up with them and find out more about that a little later. Great. In the program.
What about you, Wisso?
Well, as you can imagine, we'll be covering the, well, frankly, historical event that will be written about for decades to come, being described by some people as the most significant political event in the US for several years, probably the second or within the top three of biggest events in a young century already. Obviously, the attempted assassination of Donald Trump I'm referring to. I'll do a little editorial on that. I'll try to avoid the minutiae of the actual event, because, I mean, that's one thing to reflect on, actually, is the way the media treats these enormous historical events, the way there's just information that's repeated endlessly with very little detail and insight. So rather than going into the detail of exactly what happened, I'm trying to look at some of the political consequences of where we might head next in the United States.
RCR FM 92.1.
If you're a regular listener to the program, you will, of course, know we've been covering the Disrupt Burrup Hub campaign. Currently, the West Australian and federal Labor governments are considering applications for a 50-year extension to Woodside's Burrup Hub project in the state's northwest. If the project is allowed to go ahead, it will emit 6 billion tonnes of carbon dioxide into the atmosphere until 2070. Disrupt Burrup Hub is also concerned that the Browse gas field will threaten the fragile Scott Reef, the only nesting habitat for endangered sea turtles, and will interrupt whale migration routes. As such, there's been ongoing actions to try and disrupt Burrup Hub. And on Friday, things escalated when at 4 a.m, two activists blocked access to the only road into Woodside's Burrup Hub. Schoolteacher Petrina Harley and student Emma, 17-year-old student Emma, chained themselves to concrete barrels inside an SUV and a boat parked across Burrup Road. And this morning I had the opportunity to chat to 17-year-old Emma about the action. And I started just by asking her what happened on early Friday morning and why was she getting involved in such direct action?
So last Friday at around, I think, 4:10 a.m, which is about the time of a shift change in the Woodside workers, me and another activist set up a blockade on Burrup Road, which is the only road in and the only road out of Woodside's operations on the Burrup Hub in Karratha. And so we parked a boat and a car, both of which had concrete barrels and lock-on devices sunk into them, and attached ourselves to those on the road to block it. And I guess I took this action because I'm a young person. I'm really, really scared for my future. And Woodside Spar Up Hub will be the most polluting fossil fuel project ever in Australia. And it's just, you know, one of these projects that is a symptom of Australia's like extractivist and colonial system that is just perpetuating and profiting off of climate destruction and climate collapse. So I guess I felt pretty compelled to take direct action to actually intervene at the point of emissions rather than, you know, doing what I've been doing for the last little while, which is just, you know, talking to MPs and talking to politicians and writing letters and things, which really isn't changing anything because these are the people who are profiting off of the destruction of our environment and my future and, you know, sacred First Nations country.
Definitely. Now, I guess regular listeners would be quite aware of the Burrup Hub project and the Burrup Hub expansion. The WA and federal Labor governments are currently considering applications for a 50-year extension to Woodside's Burrup Hub project. As you mentioned there, it's a huge fossil fuel emitter. If the project's allowed to go ahead, it will emit some 6 billion tonnes of carbon dioxide into the atmosphere until 2070. Well, what is the current state of the project? I know that Disrupt Burrup Hub have been very much involved in trying to bring awareness around, you know, what's happening up there, and also the Browse gas field as well. And, you know, there's been some really courageous action. However, it's at this point, it does seem as though it is, you know, all steamrolling ahead. What is the current state of play? And, you know, I guess, what hope do we have of potentially blocking this project at this point?
Yeah, it's a bit scary watching it. Hey, our government has kind of done everything they absolutely can to make sure that it goes ahead. So at the moment, we're still waiting for some key decisions on the Browse Basin, which is an absolutely terrifying, like the worst part of the Burrup Hub. It'll mean drilling through the Scott Reef, which is one of the World Heritage listed reefs and provides homes for so many beautiful endangered animals like whales. It'll be the biggest gas field in so-called Australia. So we're waiting for a decision from, I believe, the Environment Minister, I think federally on that one. And that also links into a decision that needs to be made about the extension of the Northwest Shelf Processing Facility, which would process the gas that's coming from the Browse Basin, because there's been a proposal to extend the life of that to 2070, which really is a bit scary because I'm only 17 now, but in 2070 I'll be pretty old, and I know for sure that gas and fossil fuels can't be a part of my future then. So yeah, it is a bit scary because our government, you know, they're hand in hand with companies like Woodside perpetuating this destruction. But we do still have quite a bit of hope to stop these things, especially with Browse and the Northwest Shelf, given that a lot of the Burrup Hub relies on the Northwest Shelf as a processing facility. Yeah.
Yeah, definitely. Now, I guess I don't want to focus on it too much, but, you know, I guess in a lot of media, when young people take direct action or get involved in things such as Student Strike for Climate, or, you know, in this case, Disrupt Burrup Hub, or elsewhere in the country of people being involved in the Blockade Australia and so forth, there's that constant sort of ridiculous line of like, well, what do these young people know? They're only sort of, you know, 17 or 16 or 18. They don't necessarily understand the political situation, all that kind of nonsense. I mean, but what do you, obviously that's something you probably have dealt with in the past and you probably will have to deal with in the future.
Yeah.
In this, you know, unfortunate conservative media landscape. But what is your, I guess, response to that, to play devil's advocate? If someone says to you, well, you know, look, you're only 17, you know, wait a few more years and you might understand why we need to, you know, spend all this money on fossil fuel extraction and destroy the country.
Yeah, well, I'll be the first to admit that I'm not like a scientific genius on anything, but I also think that we're at a point in the world where you don't need to be ridiculously smart. There's like kids as young as like 3 who understand it, that we're in a state where we're reaching climate collapse and that we need to do everything we can to stop that. I don't think it really requires like a degree in such and such or like life experience to understand that the actions that we're taking now are really bad and will end to the destruction of a lot of beautiful things in this world, and that we really should be living in a system that protects the environment and protects the things that we love rather than destroying them in the name of like money and greed. I think, and I also think that being a young person in this world, you're exposed already to so many things. It's kind of hard not to take a stand. Like, for me, I live in the Southwest, and I've been pretty exposed to bushfires. And last summer, I watched the forest that I've grown up around die due to lack of rainfall, which we all know, and even really young kids know it's caused by climate change. So, yeah, I think we're all pretty educated. It's just, it comes from being alive at this point in time.
Very well said. Now, I guess for a lot of people, they're perhaps aware of what's happening. You did mention there, significant lack of rainfall this season. There's we spoke to someone not long ago who talked about what's been now referred to as the brown off in the Southwest, where we've had a huge patches of our forests and native forests die off. We are, of course, seeing the catastrophic effects of climate change already here in Australia and elsewhere around the world. But I guess for a lot of people, it can be quite disempowering, and it feels as though we don't have any means by which to take action. As someone who's now done this action and participated with Disrupt Borough Pub, what would you say to someone who isn't sure what to do? Do you feel it can be empowering getting involved in these campaigns and taking direct action? And would you encourage other people to get active and get involved?
100%. I used to feel really overwhelmed by all the interconnected issues that are happening in this world right now before I got involved in activism about 4 years ago. And yeah, I think it's the most empowering and effective thing you can do is to get involved with the direct action campaign. There's so many across this continent. Disrupt Borough Pub, you've got Blockade Australia, you've got local community projects. If you're someone out there who's feeling overwhelmed, that's the first thing I'd say to do. Quick little plug that Disrupt Borough Pub is having a little kind of get together on the 31st of Wednesday from 6 to 8, I think, at Earthwise in Subiaco, if that's something you want to get involved in. But yeah, I think taking action creates hope, and hope is something we all need to hold on to at this moment to, build the world that we want to see.
That was Emma, a 17-year-old high school student who took part in a Disrupt Borough Hub action on Friday. Herself and high school teacher Petrina Harley blocking access to Burrup Road, the main road to the Woodside's Burrup Hub project. And you're on the Indie Media Show on RTR FM 92.1 with myself, Raymond, Martin Alexander Wisson, and Joni Boyd.
Hello.
That's Ma Wisson to you, right?
Ma Wisson. I forgot we've changed.
Didn't have my mic on there. Sorry, Ma Wisson.
Ma Wisson. Not to be confused with the other Ma. Used to be on RTR FM's airwaves. But no, Ma Wisson, Joni, and myself.
RTR FM 92.1.
Last week, the federal Labor government announced it would remove sex work from the NDIS, which was available under the scheme after a court case in 2020. As they're rolling it back as part of cutbacks to disability services, sort of austerity program to save what they call bloating costs on the NDIS. Sex worker and disability rights organisations have denounced the decision. Earlier, I chatted to Lua from Decrim WA and Smut Club to discuss the move, and I started by asking them how they relate to the issue.
I usually describe myself as a multiply disabled person. For anyone who doesn't know, that means that I have multiple disabilities. And for me, that includes physical, psychosocial, and chronic illnesses. And for the last decade, I've been involved in sex work in various ways as my abilities have declined.
Yeah, because it's often that lots of sex workers are disabled, I've been told.
Yes, it's very common.
Yeah, so let's get into this decision by Bill Shorten to ban sex work from the NDIS. Could you run us through what the decision sort of involves and what's happening with that?
Sure. I guess from my perspective or my personal take as a brief, so the Labor government has submitted the NDIS Amendment Bill, or also known as NDIS Reform. The
the wider community of disabled people have voiced a lot of overwhelming concern and fears about this bill before it was even released. And they've not really been listened to. So there's many points in the bill that make it really concerning. And banning the use of sex workers is just one of those.
Yeah, well, what are some of the other ones?
So some of the other, like, just general main points are, look, the proposed bill, which is, there's a lot of resources around at the moment that go through it in a really easily digestible way. But many of the concerns from the disability community is that this bill seems to completely go against the United Nations Conventions on Rights of Persons with Disabilities and their principles. Essentially, it appears to go against, equal human rights for people with disabilities. And another of the concerns is just that it simply doesn't align with the original statements of intent for the NDIS program.
So they're essentially looking to, save a whole bunch of money by cutting back what they see as unnecessary services while, the government continues to spend billions on, weapons and tax cuts for the rich and stuff like that. But in the meantime, they're trying to find, the tiniest little things that they can shave off of the one of the most important programs we have to protect vulnerable people in this country.
Yes, entirely right, yes.
So when it comes to the ban on sex work, how common is it for sex workers to serve clients through the NDIS?
So recently, Bill Shorten, was quoted saying that, there was only proof of one or two cases of this ever happening. But he also, in the same quote, says that it was completely financially unsustainable.
Which doesn't really add up, does it?
Not make any sense. It doesn't add up.
Unless hiring a sex worker costs like $1 million or something like that.
Yeah, definitely. Even the highest rate sex workers that I've ever heard of would not remotely come.
Yeah, exactly.
Definitely doesn't check out. I can't really speak for all of sex workers, nor do I speak for all NDIS participants. What I can say, though, is that in my experience, over 10 years in the industry, all of the peers that I have met, almost every single one of them has disabled clients, and many of which are on the NDIS. Mm. It definitely happens. And I think the ways that it happens is really varied as well. I think often people who aren't super educated in sex work or in disability have only one idea of what that might look like. And logistically, it happens in several different ways.
Yeah, I'm sure a lot of people have this, very specific narrative in their head that that just isn't represented in reality. So from your perspective, why is it important for disabled folks to be able to access sex work and for sex workers to be able to see disabled clients?
I think, fundamentally, disabled people should get to choose if accessing a sex worker interests them, just like everybody else gets to choose how they spend their own funds.
Yes.
So some people, choose a client-provider exchange, and that feels either good or affirming to them. Others will only seek to explore sexual intimacy and wellness with either partners or themselves solo. It comes down to pretty simple, just disabled people deserving the same rights and autonomy as abled people. But yeah, like I mentioned, I think a lot of people have a very specific and narrow narrative in mind when they are responding to this. There's been a lot of community response and talk in the media. And a lot of it seems to be a fairly like defensive knee-jerk reaction without much nuance or understanding of either of these subjects.
Yeah, like I think I saw, on the 7:30 report, the 7 p.m. project, the project on Channel 10, pardon me, there was quite a heated discussion about it. And, you know, generally it came down to, well, I'm a taxpayer and I don't want to have to pay for that. And the general sort of response has been, well, you pay for, you know, Viagra on the PBS. There's
absolutely
all sorts of sexual services that are publicly, you know, funded and facilitated, and this should be no different, essentially, is the argument. Not to editorialise too much and give away my position too much.
I think you're entirely right there. Like, it's just a fact that it's already being paid for in general, and, like, all we're really asking is that if a disabled person and their chosen medical care team can prove that their access to exploring these things is inaccessible specifically due to their disability, they should get the choice whether or not to consider enlisting aids.
Mm. Rather than a bureaucrat in Canberra deciding whether or not they have access to that.
And, you know, historically, the people that are given the power for these decisions through the NDIS are often not people with specialist medical training or knowledge, and often not people that live with a disability themselves. So, yeah.
You're listening to RTRFM 92.1. I have Lua from Decrim WA and Smut Club. They're here chatting to us about the recent decision by the Labor government to ban sex work from the NDIS. Can you sort of touch on how this plays into the broader attitudes about sex work?
Yeah, I think, you know, as we briefly mentioned, like, I think firstly and fundamentally, this decision is a pretty thinly veiled attempt to generally cut spending. And to remove power and autonomy and increase surveillance, all at the expense of disabled lives. And also, with this specific point, throwing sex workers under the bus there as well. Like every marginalised minority who's ever had to sit through public debates about whether they, you know, deserve human rights or whether they are worth spending money on, worth any talks with budgets. This is definitely taking massive toll on both the disabled and sex worker communities and their mental health. A lot of the discourse has many of us in a pretty dark and hopeless place, but we're coming together, I think. Something that isn't considered enough is that there is a huge overlap in both the disabled community and the sex work community. They're very rarely two different things. An overwhelming large amount is the overlap, and overlap of other marginalised identities as well. So while the disabled community is the world's largest minority group, like queer, trans, intersex, people of colour, people that are sex workers, low-income people, disproportionately make up the numbers of people living with disabilities.
Yeah, and this decision by Bill Shorten just seems to, you know, it seems like more of a culture war, like victory that they're going for, rather than actually trying to save some money. Because, like we've said, that you know, I don't know what the actual savings that they expect this to be are, but it seems like they've really pushed this as a major issue, and it, you know, it reminds me of when you see trans issues and yeah. trans healthcare for kids, you know, really, really headlined and put out to the public when it's a really small scale issue that the general public just, you know, doesn't really have any material connection to. It just seems like a very strange reactionary move from the government.
Yeah, I definitely, you know, I feel that it's quite calculated in that they're well aware that it would be, you know, a very controversial talking point, I think, and that would get a lot of emotions going rather than rationale. So on the surface, obviously, it's like a melting pot of ableism and whorephobia going on there. But I think bigger picture, it's greater white right-wing conservative politics, eugenics, and upholding capitalism and colonialism.
Yeah, and pushing through neoliberal austerity, like, well, yes, if this group doesn't deserve this, then what do you deserve, you know, to the sort of broader, you know, majority voter, I suppose.
And I think there's also like a much bigger picture of international social climate as well, with ongoing COVID pandemic, multiple genocides, which are mass disabling events. There's a lot of bigger picture things that we should be just aware of, especially when it is quite common to, you know, use very sort of inflammatory points to grab onto, you know, very clickbaity kind of small parts of the large picture.
Yeah. Unfortunately, we are starting to run out of time, Lua. So if we could wrap up with just what our listeners could do to protest this decision, if they're so inclined, or to just support sex workers and the disabled community in general.
Awesome. Perfect. So I think, I mean, initially, like, listen to sex workers, disabled people. If people are willing to act and are looking for ways that they can do their bit for that, I would strongly urge everyone to head to PWDA, People with Disability Australia, to complete their survey. There are multiple easy email templates to send on Do-Gooder, one from the Greens and a general one as well, and Progressive Therapeutic Collective and the Greens on Instagram both have really easy links in their bios to be able to send emails and sign petitions.
Lua there from Decrim WA and Smart Club chatting to me a little earlier about the decision to remove sex work from coverage on the NDIS and the sort of, you know, austerity, cultural politics around that and its impact on disabled folks.
If you're enjoying this podcast, you might like to check out others on offer at RTRFM.
Like the award-winning podcast Songlines, chart-topping Sovereign, First Pressing, Mortgage Mag and Favourites Movie Squad.
Plus, don't miss the wild orbit of Planet Perth with Jeff Bullen. Tune in to Australian Melodrama with Libby Noble and meet local authors on Between the Lines with Danielle Raphael.
Head to rdrfm.com.au or wherever you get your podcasts.
There's so much to explore on your home of alternative stories, RTRFM.
So as we said at the top of the show, it would be obviously very peculiar not to make at least a few editorial comments on the attempted assassination of Donald Trump yesterday. Clearly one of the most significant events of a still young century, seismic, historical, etc. There's lots of adjectives you could use, and there's lots of vectors or angles of approach that we could take in terms of Discussing this event, or rather than going through the minutiae of the event itself, we've all been glued to the news, I'm sure. I thought I'd talk a little bit about some of the potential consequences and some of the, if you like, meta-narratives around it, the cultural and media aspects. One place to start might be, and Joni and I were talking about this off-air, is that it's a moment to reflect. There are many such moments, really, in the media cycle on the peculiar spectacular mediated culture that we live in, where such a historical event becomes memeified and comedified, if that's a verb, within 10 minutes, that memes about Trump's right ear and about the suspected shooter, and the instantly iconic image, of course, which will be published for decades, hints of Donald Trump raising the fist. One has to be honest about this, by the way. He was very brave and defiant in the moment. The bloodied face shouting, fight, 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 instantly historical, iconic image, and the way that becomes replicated and repeated and distributed across the world, across the internet, by millions and millions of people, literally within minutes. So that it's kind of an interesting thing to reflect on, because it's sort of a hyper version of this instant, immediate, communicable, memeified culture that we live in now. And further on that image, I mean, hardly an original thought on my point. This is something that people were pointing out within minutes, is that there's a sense in which he almost anticipated this moment, that there was, when he said, wait, and it created that image as a sort of an awareness of precisely the projection of the image, the media image he was creating, which a wherewithal on his part and a certain bravery, and I think it's probably secured him many more votes. I think one interesting historical aspect, as somebody who's sort of studied history, it's interesting to reflect on as well, and there's a certain kind of, it's very hard to process an event like this intellectually, let alone sort of viscerally, the shock of it. But intellectually, it's hard to reconcile two very contradictory things, which is, on the one hand, the enormous historical impact of this event that people will be writing about, for literally decades to come. As I say, probably one of the two or three, certainly in the top five, you could argue, important events of the century. Russian invasion of Ukraine, September 11th, attempted assassination of Trump would have been even more seismic had he died. But on the one hand, there's an enormous historical epic quality to it. On the other hand, a 20-year-old kid that's actually catalysed this event. And so that's for one for the history buffs. It comes to mind the Archduke Franz Ferdinand being the most obvious example, Austro-Hungarian who was assassinated, again, by a lone gunman, Gabriel Principe. That sets off a chain of events, as we know, that leads to the First World War, the Kennedy assassination, whether that was really Lee Harvey Oswald. So on the one hand, there's that what historians have referred to as a black swan event, where it's a kind of a seemingly totally random event that is unpredictable by its very nature, created and catalyzed by a random lone actor individual that is not, in some sense, a traditional social historical agent. And yet that random act by that random individual takes place in the context of, what is an incredibly febrile, unstable political atmosphere. And that's the real point to take away. And I think there's a danger in speculating too much in the prediction game and becoming almost panicked in one's thinking. I was accused, actually, by somebody being very, very uncharitable on Facebook yesterday of being panicked in some of my comments, which I thought was, the reason I call that uncharitable is because I think at one level it's hard not to panic, actually, about the potential implications of this. But on the other hand, one has to sort of calm down a bit. So I've just said I wouldn't speculate, but now I will, which is, what are the possibilities? I think one is a partial form of martial law, not necessarily in direct response to the attempted assassination, but in terms of what the events that will follow. We know that the Republican National Convention is happening in Milwaukee. Now, that's Milwaukee, Wisconsin, oddly enough, is a state where it's got an open carry law. So protests will be allowed, or it won't be right in the convention, or there'll be, it's some distance from the convention centre. But people legally are allowed to carry arms there. So that's causing enormous consternation for the Secret Service and the FBI right there immediately in terms of what's going to happen at that Republican National Convention. Democratic National Convention happening in the next month. An obvious possibility is, let's call it a counterstrike. Is somebody going to take a shot at Biden? It's a gruesome point to make, but clearly this is an inspiration to some people. There are tens of millions of guns in the United States. There are Lord knows how many, you know, whether they're mentally unstable, whether this Thomas Brooks, the shooter, was mentally unstable, remains to be seen. But that so many people that might then take a shot at Biden, does that then institute some form of martial law? There have been predictions of civil war for 30 years, if not longer, in the United States. One doesn't want to become alarmist about it because there are different definitions of civil war. But clearly one possibility is this escalation of what is in some sense already a low-level street war between forces of the far left, the far right. We know about what happened at Charlottesville in North Carolina a few years ago with the killing of an anti-fascist activist. We know that there are many militia groups, not just the Proud Boys, but many others throughout the country who are heavily armed, heavily organised and motivated, and will be inspired, when I say inspired by what happened, inspired by anger and revenge in terms of defending their man, their candidate. There is this whole sense now connected with religiosity, the messianic culture that we know exists among, you know, evangelical Christians, the intersection between that evangelical form of Christianity, nationalism, racism, and supporting Trump, that is now bound up with a sense of Trump as a martyr. That is a hugely important part of it. And I think for people who aren't of that religious nationalist bent, it's hard to understand, you know, just how the kind of irrational acts that can come from that intersection, combustible intersection of motivations. And I come back to that black swan element. It's going to take now just one, you know, handfuls of individuals to even further descend America into chaos now. And I suppose it, one thing to say at the background of all this is it's sort of an odd, maybe tangent to make, a lateral connection. Is reflecting on the fact that all of this is a historical failure of the left, actually, because it sort of brought me back to why is Trump so popular? Why is there so much chaos in the United States? You know, you look at the cost of living crisis there, the opiate addiction crisis, the unemployment, the poverty, the homelessness. Just this is a country that is just ruined. And you have to come back to the thing of, well, where is the left? The Democrats are a hopeless alternative. That's what the failure of the Democrats to deliver in terms of welfare, social services for working people over decades. That is the swamp from which Trump has emerged and all of this madness has emerged. So that's where there's, Joni and I were talking before about memification, you know, the comedy element. A lot of people on the left, frankly, have been quite smarmy about this in a way that I can't relate to be quite honest. And the reason I can't relate to it is this is not a time for the left to sort of, you know, make fun of what's happened. This is actually, all of this is about the left failing in America, the union movement failing in America, not providing an alternative for people, leading to such despair and fear that millions of people are backing somebody like Trump. So that's my particular take on that aspect of it. It's not a time for the left to be arrogant and obnoxious. This is a time for deep reflection on our historical failures. And it's a time for measured, sort of solidarity as well, and people just comforting each other without getting too hippy-dippy about it. I frankly was pretty terrified by it, thinking about where the implications of all this. So just if people are pretty panicked and anxious and fearful about this, I think that's understandable and we should support each other through that. But anyway, we can speculate much further. There's much more to say, but clearly there's more to come. I think that's my final thought, that there's more to come. This is not an isolated event, that there's going to be more, you know, seismic events to come before the November election, which I think almost certainly Trump will win now.
And on that, Alex, I mean, you don't have to sort of go into the sort of conspiracies or into predictions. We know exactly what will happen in terms of, obviously, the Republicans will now win. But importantly, the connection to sort of security culture and the police state in America, I mean, I think whether the country is going to go into some kind of martial law or not, obviously, it has a huge impact in terms of the furthering of police powers. And you're looking at somewhere like the United States that how many years on since the Patriot Act, it's extremely repressive in terms of the powers of police and security forces. Mm. And that's something, you know, here in Australia that we should be conscious of and aware of, because This doesn't just affect the United States. This will, you know, bolster the police state and the sort of the crackdown on civil liberties here in Australia, elsewhere throughout Europe and the UK and elsewhere in the world. Really, when something like this happens, it just gives further justification for the diminishing and, you know, curtailing of civil liberties.
Yeah, and people need to be careful what they say, frankly, on social media. I'm not going to name them, but some of my friends and comrades said things that were pretty irresponsible, not very sensible on social media. Just, well, I won't say what they said, but, you know, sitting in Australia making certain remarks about what happened yesterday, you might be fine. But that's absolutely right, Ray. I mean, and I'm sure that's the case, that comrades in the United States will quite rightfully and understandably reflect on things they might have said before yesterday they won't say now on social media, because we know the way National Security Agency database analysis works in terms of red flags, how that links with FBI raids on anarchists, etc. So, I mean, that's clearly an immediate ramification. If you're saying certain things about Trump, that you said on, you know, 2 days ago that you're saying now, you may well be raided by Federal Bureau of Investigation agents. I mean, that's not a joke.
And just ideologically, it demonstrates the further shift towards a more authoritarian capitalist state. That, you know, we've had this sort of odd mixture of neoliberalism and authoritarianism pop up around the world in different, and, you know, we've just sort of covered obviously the French elections and so forth, what had a, you know, much more positive outcome, but you do get these odd bedfellows now of extremely authoritarian nationalist, well, they're not even odd bedfellows really, but, you know, far right political parties with, you know, the absolute corporate neoliberal I guess markets, and we're going to see furthering of that. And that's, you know, really, this is, I think, what it's an event that will really galvanize that new form of politic, of, you know, real, a proper authoritarian state capitalism.
Oh, there's no question. I mean, again, we'll move on to the news shortly, but there's, make no mistake, there's thousands of far right Americans gearing up, buying more ammo, buying guns, getting more organized. They're ready to go. Now, what form that takes, we don't yet know, but it's clearly pretty frightening if you think about it for too long. Hence why people spread memes about it instead of reflecting on it seriously.
All right, boys, what do you reckon? Should we go for a track, or should we...
Maybe we should just jump straight into the headlines while we're there. We've only got a few more minutes left of the program. Coming up after 12, though, Rhiann Todd-Hunter is going to take you out to lunch. Hopefully try and lift the mood a little bit.
At least calm us down. You usually get those nice chill ambient
exactly,
tracks at the beginning.
Exactly. But no, a few headlines. Jenny.
Yes. So on Saturday, Israeli fighter jets and drones unleashed a barrage of missiles and bombs, obliterating tents in Al-Mawasi camp, where thousands of displaced Palestinian families had sought shelter. Palestinians have described the attack, which killed at least 90 people and injured 300, as a horrific massacre. And I believe since that headline came out, the death toll has risen. In Israel, the first results of the military's investigation into its response to the October 7 attack by Hamas was published Thursday. The report finds the military was unprepared for the incursion into Kibbutz Be'eri and was slow and disorganized in its response. Over 100 Israelis were killed and another 30 were taken hostage from Be'eri. The report, however, denied that hostages killed during a standoff between Hamas and Israeli soldiers were killed in friendly fire, as some have suggested, though it did not offer evidence that Hamas killed them. Members of Kibbutz Be'eri expressed dissatisfaction with the military assessment.
Staying in the Middle East, in Saudi Arabia, a man has been sentenced to 20 years in prison for charges related to his social media activity. Asad Al-Ghamdi, a 47-year-old teacher, was arrested in November and convicted of publishing false information and, I quote, challenging the religion and justice of the king and the crown prince. He was held incommunicado and placed in solitary confinement in Jeddah prison. He has also been denied medical attention for his epilepsy, suffering multiple seizures while in custody, according to Human Rights Watch. And in related news, in the UAE, the United Arab Emirates, over 40 lawyers, academics and political dissidents were sentenced to between 10 years to life in prison last week, following a mass trial that human rights groups are denouncing as a sham. More than 80 people were tried, many of whom had already been convicted years ago and were serving prison sentences for the same or similar offences. Human Rights Watch said the proceedings were marred by serious due process and fair trial violations, including the use of torture. And here in Australia, there's, and connected to our interview today regarding disrupt Bar Pub. A second Blockade Australia protester has received a jail sentence after he suspended himself above a railway track in Newcastle last week. 21-year-old Sam Gribben, who is from Bellingen, has appealed his one-month jail sentence and been released on bail. He'll face course this week. This is carry on from another 21-year-old facing a similar sentence. Laura Davey appealed their two-month jail sentence last Monday after they were convicted for securing themselves to a piece of machinery at a Newcastle coal terminal. As we covered on the show, Blockade Australia has been disrupting the railway and port in Newcastle with daily actions since the 25th of June, and they're calling for a change to the economic and political system to achieve meaningful climate action.
Yeah, and just briefly, the huge story developing around the Victorian branch of the construction union. Those who've seen 60 Minutes or have been following the Fairfax reports, led by Nick McKenzie, who actually a pretty good investigative journalist, will say that will have seen that John Setka has resigned as Victorian Secretary. Allegedly, there's a connection with because of those connections with bikie gangs and organised crime figures. The latest news, pretty dramatic. As of this morning, the National Executive of the Construction, Forestry, Mining, Energy Union has put the Victorian branch into administration and taken direct control of it, subject to further investigations. The ACTU executive is having an emergency meeting on Wednesday to basically look into this matter. We'll hope to cover this next week. I mean, there's a lot to say about this, but you know, putting aside for a moment the veracity or otherwise of those criminal connections between John Setka, and bikies, etc., like clearly this is an opportunity for the ruling class and the Albanese government to go after the CFMU. Setka's been a thorn in Albanese's side for years, and there's talk now by federal ministers of deregistration of the Victorian branch of the CFMU. So, pretty huge story. We'll hope to cover that for you next week.
And just one more thing I would like to plug again, the survey that Lua talked about during our chat about the NDIS, the People with Disability Australia, PWDA, have an opportunity to have your say on the NDIS amendment bill, which has yet to go through the Senate. So if you're on the NDIS and want to have your say on that, you can search PWDA NDIS survey and you should be able to find it. And the details of the Radiothon party are out for this year.
There you go. Exciting stuff.
But anything else, lads?
That's it. That's pretty much it.
Ray's completely zoned out. He's
No. I was looking. There is a Disrupt Bar Pub meeting coming up at that Emma mentioned, but you can just, I haven't got the details on me. You can find out more by looking them up on your various devices and get along to that to get involved in that campaign. But Rhiann coming up very shortly with Out to Lunch. We'll be back next week at 11 a.m. Get along and restream any of our content. You can restream this show at rtrfm.com.au. Thanks so much, Journey.
In the meantime, don't hate the media.
Become the media.